Welcome to Middle School Walk and Talk, a podcast series offering heart, hope, and health to members of our middle school communities. Hosts Phil Svegel and Jessica McGuire talk all things self-care, student well-being, school culture, and more. Middle School Walk and Talk is designed to support the concepts found in the successful middle school, This We Believe, and is a production of the Association for Middle Level Education. To learn more, visit amle.org. Today's episode, when kids don't know how to attribute success or failure, they make up reasons, with special guest Miriam Platinsky.
Hi everyone, it's so good to see you, Jessica, and to be here with Miriam Platinsky, who just released a new book, Writing Their Future Selves, and had a long career as an English teacher and is currently an instructional specialist in Montgomery County Public Schools. So Miriam, we're so glad to have you here with us today.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Miriam, I want to say I finished your new book, Writing Their Future Selves, just this morning. And I want to say it's one of the most beautifully written professional development books that I've ever read. You're very welcome. As a professional development book, I just ate it up. The writing in it is very good and the content is great, but the idea of empowering students to find a sense of worth for themselves within the classroom comes through every page of your book. And a large part of your book is centered around students' academic identity. Could you talk to us a little bit about what you mean by academic identity and define that for our listeners a little bit as we get started?
Absolutely. So the way I usually explain academic identity is that we talk a lot about building rapport with kids and learning about who they are as people. And I think that is incredibly important, and I do not want to downplay that at all. What happens, however, is that it can be a little limiting. And I think a lot, and I think I used this example somewhere in the book, you know, a student of mine was really into baking and we share that. So we could talk about baking before class. But then I realized over time that didn't necessarily mean that the same student was comfortable speaking about content and sharing answers or responses or just ideas in class. And so for me, the idea of academic identity is the sense of yourself as a validated learner, thinker, and scholar. So it's when we prioritize kids, not just for who they are, but also for their ideas and the value that they bring to the classroom, and also how we normalize everything they say, right or wrong. And in fact, we celebrate the mistakes because they are pathways to learning. So it's really about helping kids understand that we value their brains as well as their identities as people. Because I think you need both of those things to really be able to tap into what kids are learning.
I feel like, especially, you know, in a podcast that's centered around middle level education and middle schoolers, they in and of themselves are trying to find themselves so much. But also, I find at the middle school level that students carry forth some of the stereotypes that have been assigned to them at certain points in time. And so your book is full of practical strategies, really, for teachers of all content areas to help students break down some of those stereotypes. And I found it interesting that all of the strategies in your book are cross-content. And you do a lot of talking about writing being an area that can weave its way through that, and an area where students can really find like access to a point of achievement. I found that interesting as I was reflecting upon my own middle school, where almost always, if I'm in a discussion with a student, they will mention the hardest content area for them, and writing always comes almost always to the surface of that. So I found it interesting that the book was centered around using writing in ways to empower students, because it's a very vulnerable place for them. And you have to be vulnerable to be a writer. But I just appreciated that very much, that was woven throughout the book. I also think you did a lot of talking about professional development for teachers. Can you tell us a little bit about your ideas on the best professional development for teachers?
Well, I know that the expression is that the most pervasive form of professional development for teachers is the teacher next door, down the hall. So it's the person that you talk to the most. And, one thing that I really do believe, I have a few very strong beliefs around professional development. And the first is that whatever you're doing with people, they have to be able to take it back into their classrooms immediately, if not sooner. So they really have to see the relevance. They've done so many studies. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation did a really comprehensive study on professional development and found a lot of patterns. One of them was that teachers felt like they were being trained on things that they were not interested in being trained on, that they had never asked for. And I talk about this a lot in my second book, Lead Like a Teacher, where it's all about how we can really bring teachers more into decision-making processes, even if they are not holding official leadership positions in school buildings. And a big piece of it is, for example, I'm going into a school next week to talk about something that I have a lot of passion for, which is how do we get kids to talk more? And one of the first questions that I ask is, well, what are you already doing? And also, what do you want to learn more about? Because if you're not really testing the temperature of what's already happening with teachers and what they feel comfortable with versus what they feel uncomfortable with, you're almost always going to be barking up the wrong tree with professional development. And that's why it's so incredibly common to just turn to the person who's closest to you. And that can be great, but if they're also, it's a person who has some growing to do, it's not necessarily going to elevate your practice all the time to have that be your method. So it's really, I think, helpful for school leaders to talk to teachers more about what they would like to learn.
Mary, one of the things that I really appreciate about your approach is that you recognize that, especially with middle schoolers, it has to be fun. And I had the opportunity to talk to you recently in a Q&A format, and a lot of teachers want to know about the kinds of things you do and incorporate into your writing instruction to make it fun for kids. Could you share some of that with everyone listening now?
Absolutely. So, going back to the idea that writing is something that kids can do across content areas, writing is a form of expression. It's one of the four language domains. And so that's why it fits naturally pretty much everywhere. But what happens in schools a lot is we get stuck with one kind of writing or just a sort of set of writing skills. So we typically look at argumentative writing, analytical writing, and sometimes narrative writing. And kids want to do more creative writing, more open-ended writing. So one way that I really like to facilitate that as a teacher is to dedicate a portion of a week, and it might just be 20 minutes or a half hour to doing what I call playing a writing game, which is having kids do something that really does set off their cognitive thinking in a way that it doesn't ordinarily with the other kinds of writing they're more accustomed to doing and that they're not as engaged by. So, for example, like I have this game that I invented called the Magic Box, where everyone writes down a story idea and puts it into a box. And you pull out somebody else's idea and you write their story. And you have to kind of problem solve your way around it and think, okay, well, this doesn't make sense, or I don't want to do this, but I have to put my own stamp on it. And then when we share, kids can have the option of either asking to hear their original story idea, oh, I was the one with the penguin in the airplane. Or you could say, I got this really cool idea, I'm going to share this. You could vocally do it, you could gallery walk it. There are all sorts of ways that you can get kids to share ideas through writing. And the nice thing is that if kids are not as vocal initially, it's lower risk sometimes to do the walking around or the passing around, and then you can get to a place where people are more comfortable once they're validated, sharing more out loud. And then it becomes, there's a lot of laughing in a good way, like good laughter.
One of the other questions that a couple of teachers asked in different ways related to meeting kids where they are and how you can help students who have so many rough edges without them feeling discouraged, since writing does feel so personal. And I loved your answer when we spoke that night, and if you wouldn't mind sharing it here as well, that would be great.
I spoke to a teacher who was really wondering, we have so much to correct, so much to essentially help a student with writing. How do I tell them how to do all the things? And my advice is always don't tell them to do all the things. It's really a less is more approach to helping a kid get better. And we have to do this as teachers too. This is the hard part. There are all sorts of content standards that children have to meet, whether it's in writing, reading, any content area. We have to prioritize what comes first and do so strategically. So this has to happen before this, has to happen before this. And what I recommend for teachers who are having students write anything is pinpoint three things at the most that a kid has to do. Create a student-facing, kid-friendly, language-based criteria for success checklist where you're saying, your product has this, this, and this. And when you give them feedback, it is objective, it's value-free, it's not any kind of, you know, they're not gonna feel as though you're biased because you're just focusing on those criteria and saying, okay, this happened, this didn't happen yet, here's why. And so they can really see those priorities that you've set out. They know them from the get-go. You've assigned them at the very beginning. You teach to them. You are looking for them in the draft. Peers are looking for them when they're peer reviewing and then when you're grading. And that also helps to avoid what I call the bleeding paper, which is where you're writing like millions of comments. It doesn't matter what color you write them in, by the way. I remember when I was in education school and people were like, do it in purple, it'll be better than red. It's not better. So you have these, and they're not going to read the comments because they're really demoralizing. And also they're difficult to understand. And then teachers get offended. They say, oh my God, they didn't look at anything I said. And I spent an hour grading this paper. And so my advice to teachers is to really just don't do that to yourself. Don't spend the hour grading. Focus on those whatever elements, those three elements, and then grade to that and then talk to kids about that. And then they'll have a much more focused process.
And I want to say for our teachers listening that the book gives a lot of concrete examples that teachers could take immediately after reading your book, Miriam, and put into practice about giving feedback on writing outside of, you know, or in lieu of giving a holistic grade, because we know a lot of times if there's a grade at the top of the paper, that's the first and last thing a student will look at, right? But there's a lot of concrete examples on how to give feedback to provide clarity to students. And you do a lot of talking in the book about explaining the why to kids, just like we as adults like to know the why behind our work, right? And so I found that interesting. When you look at other meta-analysis of high impact strategies in education, clarity and student self-efficacy, it, you know, leads to deep levels of learning. So to provide students with the why and tell them that upfront and give them that clarity, I think within feedback is bound to lead to not only increasing their level of belonging within the class when then they can produce those things within class, but it also gives them that clarity that they need in order to stay engaged.
And I think we often don't, we take for granted what we think students understand. So we give them an assignment or we often tell them why they're doing it. And when then we think we're done, it's over, they've got it. And it's really not that clear to students a lot of the time. When I'm teaching, I teach teachers at night and I teach them about feedback. And I show them an example of a paper that a friend of mine had in college. And all it says on it is, well done, A. Which is about as holistically vague as you can get. And you know, the thing is, when students don't know how to attribute their success or failure, they make up reasons. And very often the reasons are going to, especially in the middle school years, be the teacher likes/hates me, or, you know, I guess I'm not very good at, and they that becomes a fixed belief for them. And so we really need to remove anything that tells students that how they're doing is subjective or based on luck, so they can attribute their success or failure to specific criteria that we already gave them. And that's also called no secrets teaching, which is something I really believe in. Don't leave people wondering why, because I've always said that if you don't tell people why something is happening, adults, kids, whoever, they'll make up a story and that will become their reality. And we want it to be the right story.
And if kids are insecure, they're going to be avoidant. They're not going to want to take the risk. I would imagine they're also more likely to turn to something like AI. So I'm curious if you're seeing that and if you're able to identify it when it shows up, and any advice you have regarding AI for teachers.
AI is really fascinating right now because it has not yet been so fantastic, but it's getting there. So we heard a lot last year about ChatGPT. And right now it's sort of reached the iteration of GPT-4, which is a paid service. And the difference between the paid ChatGPT and the unpaid one is that the paid one can interact with the internet in a way that a prior version couldn't. And so it's getting better at doing what it does. The issue with kids though, is they have to know how to ask questions to AI and how to know what products they're getting in terms of quality and what the teacher is looking for, because at this point in time, we can still see a lot of what, especially younger kids, they don't know exactly how to do it. So if they say, write me an essay about, they'll just take that product and turn it in. And it's pretty obvious. As kids get older and they start to ask questions, and actually most kids I've talked to, they're not using it to cheat. They're using it as a study tool or to learn. Like I talked to a kid last week who was saying, well, my teacher's been gone for 2 weeks and I don't know how to do this. So I've been asking AI how to do it. And so they're really using it to fill in the gaps. And sometimes I kind of think, okay, well, if you know what questions to ask, and if you're learning about how to do that, you're actually doing okay, like the AI is helping you. So I'm less concerned about AI as a tool for dishonesty and just more concerned about whether or not we are as teachers figuring out how to leverage it to help kids think more. Because, you know, being afraid of it is not going to be a good strategy. It's here and it's staying and it's getting better and better. And so it can do some really cool things. Like I was playing with an AI tool last week called Gamma, which does presentations like PowerPoint type things. And I asked it to do a presentation about literature circles just to see what would happen. And it gave me all sorts of stuff. And then I started telling it to do other things. Can you please be more specific about what you mean by this in slide two? And then it gave me more stuff. And I kept correcting it and correcting it and correcting it. And I finally found out what it was, some okay stuff. It wasn't great. And so I would just also say at this point, I don't think we're at a place where it's yet doing anything really threatening.
I think probably we're still at the point where we have to worry more about parents doing their essays for them than ChatGPT. What are you seeing in that realm? And how do you handle that, or advise teachers to handle that?
So teachers almost always know especially in middle school, when a parent essay comes in, an essay that a parent has tampered with. And, you know, one thing that I really want to do is talk about it with parents at opportune times when it comes up organically, as opposed to having to then make a phone call later. So it's a really good topic for back to school night. It's a really good topic for conferences that are already scheduled, if you think there might be an issue. And just to say, listen, what we're doing in this class, the goal of the writing science we have is not to produce something super polished. It's really to help students work within their grade level standard to achieve growth in specific areas. And it's my job as a teacher to help them do that. I can't help them grow if I don't know what they can do. So what I suggest to parents is that they stay in the realm of wise counsel and not doing it for the kid. Like, for example, I am helping my daughter with an essay this weekend, and she was really discouraged because I looked at it and I realized that she had not followed the format of what the teacher had asked for. And so I just highlighted places. I made a copy of the essay. I highlighted, like, okay, so here's a place where you could do this. I was making suggestions, but I never wrote a word for her. If I did, she would be a lot happier than she is right now because she's downstairs working on it. So I think the idea is that we help them and we give them advice, but we also consider that the teacher themselves, you know, as a parent, if my student's coming home saying, I can't do this, and I'm in a place where I'm even thinking about writing it for them, I make contact with the teacher and say, you know, how can we collaborate to help my kid do this? Because writing is a learned skill, and we have to normalize that. No sixth, seventh, or eighth grader should be, I mean, some students naturally do have an affinity for writing. But even so, I was reading a poem. My dad was an English professor and he was really gifted. And he, you know, I always thought of him as brilliant, but I just read a poem that he wrote in the seventh grade that my mom dug up. It was a poem that a seventh grader would write. So, you know, we have to think about where kids are developmentally with age and stage.
Kind of suggestive of where we all are at this point in the year. What are things that you would advise teachers to do to make them, to help them work smarter rather than harder? Work smarter rather than harder at this point in the year.
Well, sort of going back to that theme of less is more, I often tell teachers who are saying, you know, the kids are overwhelmed, and you know, this is a phrase that we sort of naturally recoil against, the kids can't. And of course, I really don't like hearing that, because that is a sort of a deficit mindset way to express things. So what I do is I say, okay, let's think about like how we're approaching the work. So for example, we want kids to read a certain amount every day. We want them to write a certain amount every day. These are good, you know, markers for their achievement. Do they have to do all of everything every single moment? So if you want, for example, if your goal is for kids to grow their skills with, say, informational text, we have informational text in science, we have it in social studies, we have it in pretty much every content area. Do they have to read the entire article that day or the entire chapter in the textbook? Or is there a way that we can, you know, judiciously chunk the work and then allow time for them to process in different ways, externally process, internally process? It's really about pulling out our teacher bag of tricks and trying to make sure that the trick to teaching is not having a bunch in your repertoire. So we all have a ton of tools in our toolbox as we continue to teach. The question is, can we match our tools to the students we have in front of us in the right time and place? So if I'm seeing that kids are burned out at a particular time of year, or if they're having a hard time on a certain day or they're distractible, can I pick the right strategies at that moment that will help them? And does that mean flexibility on my part in saying, okay, you know what, our original plan was to do X, but now I see that everyone's a little unfocused, so what we're gonna do instead is Y. And to me, that means, you know, it might just be, let's all write one sentence of the thing that we were going to write a whole lot of, and everyone just writes some stuff on the board, and we're going to walk around and sort of put some check marks next to it or questions, and we'll have this sort of silent conversation going on while everyone's commenting on everyone else's stuff. And that gets them moving. It helps your brain to body connection, because kids should not be sitting for more than 30 minutes without standing up for at least 90 seconds. During times of year like this, wouldn't direct instruct for more than 10 to 15 minutes at a time, because again, you're going to lose them. So just think a lot about processing time and what kids need to be able to stay cognitively sharp. I know as an adult, I need it too. If I sit down and someone pulls up a PowerPoint and is talking at me for a really long time, I'm not going to do that well either. So I think it's for all of us this time of year and other times of year too.
I think you hit the nail on the head. We're kind of coming up, at least in my neck of the woods, on the long, cold winter and the middle of the year and testing season also starting, right? All stressors on students and teachers. So I loved your advice of, instead of thinking the kids can't do it or the kids aren't doing it, how are we approaching it? Really smart just to flip the script a little bit in your own head as a teacher and think about it in a different way. Miriam, I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us today. And while your book is about students writing to find their own academic identity through how the teacher engages them and maybe breaks down stereotypes that they have in their own head, the book is really about creating also in a larger part a sense of belonging for all people, teachers within the classroom, I think, but also students. So that's one of the reasons I appreciated that so much. I don't know that there's been a podcast that Phyllis and I have done this year where belonging has not come up. And so I know that's at the heart of the mission of every middle school educator. So I want to encourage everyone to pick up your newest book, Writing Their Future Selves. I know I'm going to be checking out your other two previous books as well, which I have not had the pleasure to read yet, but I'm looking forward to. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today on Middle School Walk and Talk, Miriam.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.